loathe them are all the same, homogenized, subordinate, indebted, and powerless. That's what corruption will do, and we've allowed it to run rampant for too long. Noah looked away from the speaker to take a gauge of the crowd. Old habits die hard. Nearly everyone throughout the room was engaged and listening, but there were exceptions. A variety of men and women, about 10 or 15, were scattered around the bar, looking just slightly unlike the others. It wasn't their dress that was out of place, but rather their demeanor. They were far more concerned with one another than with what was happening on stage, and at least half of them were fiddling with small digital video cameras. "Hey," Noah whispered, tapping the table near Molly's arm. She only shushed him, keeping her attention on the woman in the spotlight. With a last uneasy glance around the room, he turned back to the speaker as well. "There are 35,000 registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C., the woman said, to a scattering of boos and hisses that arose from the onlookers. "That's nearly 70 lobbyists for each member of Congress. Together, they spent almost $3.5 billion last year. That's over $6.5 million per congressman. With that money, they buy influence, not on behalf of you, but to put forward the agendas of their clients. Huge corporations, international banks, the power brokers on Wall Street, foreign governments, media giants, the real self-appointed ruling class. Their lobbyists write the bills. Your congressmen work as scripted frontmen for the tainted legislation, and then they vote as they're told by their handlers. Not all of them, mind you. There are still good men and women in Washington, D.C., but more than enough of them have long gone bad. In return for abandoning their oath of office, they're promised fortune and fame and re-election if they play along, and if they don't, they know they can kiss their careers in so-called public service goodbye. This country was founded as a representative republic, but you're no longer represented here, are you?" A resounding no was shouted from the back, and that triggered a chorus of more shouts from every quarter of the bar. She let the clamor go on for a while and then motioned for quiet, holding up a thin document in her hand. "This is the Constitution of the United States of America. It's just about 15 pages when printed out like this, only 4 sheets of parchment when it was originally written out by hand. Here it is. That's all of it. The supreme law of the land. The entire framework of our system of government. And you know why it's so small? Because the government itself was meant to be small. Is a federal government vital and important to our country? Yes. Should it exist as the heart and symbol of our unity and a compass to guide our journey as one nation? Yes. But it was meant to be small. And why? Because we, you and I, are the real government in this land of ours. That's the forgotten truth that calls out to us from these few pages here. What the founders knew is that governments go bad. That's why Thomas Jefferson told us that resistance to tyrants is obedience to God. They understood that evil, like gravity, is a force of nature. Corruption always comes. Like weeds in a garden, it infiltrates, gets a foothold, grows, and takes over. Keep watch, we were told. Keep the government in check, or this haven of freedom and opportunity could disappear in a single generation. And my friends, we have looked away from our sacred responsibility for too long. We forgot our charge to keep eternal vigilance, and as we slept, another framework, corrupt and ever-expanding, was being built to replace our founding principles the moment they grew weak enough to fail. And now we look around and find that our future has nearly been stolen away. Our representatives in government swear an oath, when they take office, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. But for many of them, these are only empty words. They never even consult the wisdom they've sworn to uphold. Once spoken, that oath is forgotten, and the Constitution of the United States never again enters their mind. She laid the document in her hand on a nearby table and picked up a dark blue volume the size of the Brooklyn White Pages. "The entire Constitution can be folded and carried in your shirt pocket, and may I recommend that you keep a copy with you like that if you don't already. But this, she held up the massive book, is one volume of the Federal Tax Code. She dropped the book flat from waist high, and it whammed to the stage floor at her feet. 1,400 pages, and that's just one volume. There's a bookcase full of these. 67,000 pages of rules and penalties and crimes for which you're all guilty until you prove yourselves innocent. There's no due process when the Internal Revenue Service comes to kick in your front door. And do you know why they've made it so big? And why it gets bigger every year? It's the same reason the IRS is involved with health care legislation and the Treasury was in charge of enforcing prohibition. Because the power to tax involves the power to destroy. That's not my opinion. It's the opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court. But you don't need a judge to tell you what is obvious to anyone who's ever tried to fill out a tax form. The tax code is not meant to be read and understood by the people. It's meant as a shelter for those who've taken power from us, and a weapon of selective enforcement to be used against any who would dare to raise an opposing voice. The law is not for them. It's for you. Right now, 100,000 federal employees together owe almost $1 billion in back taxes, and the Treasury Secretary himself is one of them. The crowd reacted with loud boos and angry shouting, and it took a while for them to quiet down. When they finally had, she began again, but now her voice was much softer. Those of us gathered in this room tonight aren't simply fighting taxes, out-of-control spending, or unsustainable debt. We're fighting for something much larger, equal justice. We're fighting for the end of special exceptions and perks for those who have the right people on their speed dials. There's no reason why the person who runs the IRS, the congressman who writes our tax code, or the CEO who has friends in the White House should get a free pass when you and I must pay the consequences for our decisions. John Adams once said that we are a government of laws, not men. Ask yourself, is that still true today? Your income, your family name, and your connections matter more than ever. They can help you succeed, or they can ensure you fail. How can that reality coexist in a society where all men are created equal? The answer is that it can't. That is why we are here. And it's also why our message of equal justice is impossible for any honest person to refute. How do I know that? Because it was the message of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. No one noticed that the atmosphere in the bar seemed to have changed during the few minutes that the woman had been on the stage. It wasn't just that you could hear a pin drop. It was the whole feel of the place. She had them in the palm of her hand. While others throughout our history have resorted to violence to achieve their agendas, it's important to remember that they all failed. But Dr. King was different. He told people to get down on their knees, to be peaceful in their words and actions, to stay together and fight relentlessly for their cause. Dr. King understood what all of us gathered here must, that those who fight to correct injustice must be willing to accept suffering, if necessary, but never to inflict it. All of the normal activity you might expect to see in a bar had stopped. Even the waitresses and bartenders seemed to be completely focused on the words flowing from the stage. Dr. King once said that no lie can live forever. He knew that once the American people understood the depth of the injustice being perpetrated on them, they would choose the right side. Today we face that very same challenge, and if we are patient, we can expect the very same result. Americans are still a fair and just people. They know the difference between racism and race baiting, between violence and accusations of violence, between hatred and patriotism. Let them weigh the evidence for as long as they need, because when the verdict comes down, we will once again be on the right side. You're angry. I know you are, and you should be, the speaker continued. But now I need to urge you, to demand of you, that you renounce anyone who suggests violence. Just like Dr. King, we aim to eliminate evil, not those who perpetrate it. To speak of violence in any form is to play right into the hands of those who oppose us. They've already invested countless hours into portraying us as violent, hateful racists, and they are just waiting for the chance to further that storyline. Don't give it to them. Instead of Bill Ayers, give them Benjamin Franklin. Instead of Malcolm X, give them Rosa Parks. Instead of Bin Laden, give them Gandhi. They are well prepared on how to use violence to their advantage, but they have absolutely no idea how to use peace. Besides, everything we need to prevail, the woman on stage held up her printout of the Constitution again, every shield and weapon against tyranny and oppression, even at the late stages of the cancer of corruption that sickened us, everything we need is given to us right here. All we must do is find the strength and the wisdom to awaken our friends and neighbors, take back our power under the law, and restore what's been forgotten. Restore, not adapt, not transform, restore. Let me ask you all a question. Many of us in this room are painted as anti-government. But who loves America more, those who want to restore it or those who want to transform it? The hushed silence that had overtaken the room for a while evaporated in an instant. Enthusiastic shouts and chants came from all corners. The misfits at the bar even put their cameras down and turned their backs, as if by its nature this material would be of no use to them. Don't be fooled. Transformation is simply a nice way of saying that you don't like something. If you live in an old house that you adore, do you talk about restoring that home or transforming it into a modern-day McMansion? Same goes for an old car or an old painting. Things that have real value aren't changed or transformed, they're preserved. She paused and looked slowly around the room as though she were talking to each person individually. I don't know about you, but I happen to believe that the America our founders created is still worth preserving. Thank you all. God bless you, and may God bless the USA. The woman left the stage on the other side as a Toby Keith song began to play over the sound system, and Molly looked over at Noah as she applauded the end of the speech. Then she leaned toward him, raising her voice over the bar noise. So, what do you think? Noah took a thoughtful sip from his glass, then shrugged as the room quieted down. Can I get you a club soda or some juice?
No, thanks. What did you think of what she said?
I don't know. I guess it sounds like she believes what she's saying.
Wow, Molly said. That could be the most noncommittal string of words I've ever heard a man put together. You really are a PR executive.
I'm sorry, he said. I don't like to talk about politics. I've always thought it was kind of a waste of time.
So if I'm hearing this correctly, you're willing to grant that the person who was up there speaking, my mother, by the way, probably believed what she was saying, and yet it's not worth a second of your time to even think about.
That was your mother? Noah asked.
Just answer the question.
No, I didn't say that. It's complicated.
No, she said flatly. It really isn't.
Could we change the subject just for a few minutes? I don't want to argue with you.
That horse is already out of the barn, Mr. Gardner.
Okay, then listen. I see how people of a certain mindset could start to hate the government.
We don't hate government. We're against an out-of-control government that's lost sight of its principles and has been overrun by corruption.
All right, point well taken. I understand that you're upset about what's being done to the country.
I'm so glad you understand that.
I do. Things are bad, and they're going to get a lot worse before this crash is over. But all this... He gestured around at the bar full of people. What do you all think you're accomplishing here?
We're getting together and taking a stand.
Taking a stand? Against what? Against the way things have always been? Because that's not going to change.
Molly shifted in her seat to square off with him, then looked into his eyes. Why did you really come here tonight?
He sighed and sat back. I guess I just wanted to get to know you.
Well, she said, this pointless meeting, that deluded woman on stage, and all these other misguided people, that's me. Now you know me. With that, she gathered her things and left him sitting there alone with his beer. Chapter 11. Noah had lost count of the refills after his first pint, but by then he was averaging around 32 ounces of suds per special guest speaker. He'd briefly considered playing a drinking game with himself, wherein he would pound one back each time he heard one of the dirty words progressive, socialist, or globalism. But by those rules, he'd have drunk himself under the table within a few minutes. Their spiels were all different, but the highlights were mostly the same, with only minor deviations in two areas: where to place the blame for their country's troubles, and what to do about it. He was still in his lonely seat by the stage. After he'd struck out with Molly, there was no real reason to hang around, but he felt too beat to get up and leave. Besides, the angry beer buzz he was stoking seemed like the best medicine for putting this malignant night into remission. The nearby crowd parted at the end of another onstage musical interlude. He'd been hoping to see the waitress bringing him another tall one, but instead it was a familiar, enormous bearded man who walked up to the table. Hollis, no last name had been offered for him, gently touched the bar stool across from Noah with a finger. The expression on the part of his face not covered with bristly hair asked politely if that seat was taken.
"Please," Noah said, "be my guest."
The barstool looked like dollhouse furniture next to this soft-spoken behemoth, but somehow it held up as he sat down.
"Though I'll tell you the truth, when you've got your choice of a few hundred people here who I guarantee are better company than me, I wonder why you'd decide to sit here."
The waitress came and put a beer down for Noah and a bottle of Coca-Cola for his new table mate. Hollis waited until she was gone to answer.
"I don't know," he said. "You looked kind of sad, I guess."
As if to drip gasoline on Noah's already smoldering mood, tonight's headliner, the illustrious Danny Bailey, now took to the stage in a swell of heavy metal music and an ovation that rattled every shelf of glassware behind the bar.
"Hello, New York!"
Bailey shouted, like an aging rock star kicking off his annual farewell tour. He held out the microphone to pump up the roar of the answering crowd and made no move to settle them down. On the contrary, the clamor continued until he produced a piece of paper and took back the mic almost a full deafening minute later.
"Thank you, really. I could listen to that all night long. Let me see if this is my crowd, though. How can we tell if a politician is lying?"
He turned the mic briefly to the crowd again for their answer.
"Their lips are moving," the people shouted. "That's right," Bailey said. "And watch what they name things, especially those bills they're all voting on without even reading them. If they call something the Patriot Act, you can bet it won't be long before they're using it to hunt down us patriots. If it's called net neutrality, it's going to be used to neutralize their enemies. If it's called the Fairness Doctrine, it's meant to unfairly put free speech under government control and create a chilling effect on your First Amendment rights. Immigration reform, healthcare reform, do me a favor, when you hear them say the word reform, I want you to hear the word transform. And the next question you've got to ask is, what are they trying to transform us into? A better, stronger, freer country? Or a place filled with more and more people who are easier to control, easier to exploit, easier to keep under their thumb?" This drew a loud and positive reaction from the crowd, which continued until Bailey produced a piece of paper and made a motion to quiet them down. "Hey, is anybody out there looking for a job? Unemployment just shot up past 20%. Real unemployment, that is, not the bogus numbers we get spoon-fed on the nightly news. And that's nothing. It's almost 40% if you're a young black man in this free country of ours. Since I thought maybe some of you might be looking for a new career, I brought this job opportunity for you."
He held the printout in his hands at an angle so he could read from it under the lights.
"I found this last week on a government website. It's a really good job for what they call an internment and resettlement specialist."
The crowd's reaction was immediate, loud, and angry.
"Now calm down, give it a chance. Of all the world's prisoners, we've got 25% of them right here in this country. And hell, the U.S. has only 5% of the planet's population, so there must be a disproportionate number of undesirables in America, don't you think?"
A man just outside the circle of the spotlight handed up a stack of stapled papers.
"Oh, wait!"
Bailey continued, hamming up an incredulous reaction to the new document on top.
"What's this? I don't believe we're supposed to see this. This is Army Regulation 210-35, dated almost 5 years ago. And will you look at that? The title is Civilian Inmate Labor Program. Maybe this is what they need all those new internment and resettlement specialists for."
Another burst of outrage from the crowd.
"Now hold your horses. These are dangerous criminals. After all, somebody's got to keep them in line, right? Why not put them in a military work camp where we can get some free labor out of them? As long as we're not the criminals, we've got nothing to worry about."
He flipped to another one of the documents in his hands.
"But what do we have here? A memo from 1970, written by a man who later became the director of FEMA, advocating the rounding up and internment of 21 million, quote, American Negroes, unquote, in the event of civil disorder. Now, I left my exact figures at home, but I believe at that time 21 million would have been roughly all of the black people in America. And here," he squinted as he read briefly from the document on top of his stack, "United States Air Force Civil Disturbance Plan 55-2 will authorize and direct the Secretary of Defense to use the U.S. Armed Forces to restore law and order in the event of a crisis. Under this umbrella plan, they ran an exercise in 1984. So you see, they do have a sense of humor. And that exercise was called Rex 84. The purpose was to see how efficiently they could pick up and corral all those disobedient Americans on their lists." Bailey held up document after document as he continued. "What lists, you ask? All kinds of them. The FBI's ADEX list from the late 1960s. ADEX, that stands for Agitator Index. It was full of dangerous intellectuals, union organizers, and people who spoke out against the Vietnam War. Now there's almost 1.5 million people on the DHS terrorist watch list, and it's growing by 20,000 names every month. Have you registered a firearm? You're on a list. Have you made a political contribution to a third-party candidate? You're on a list. Have you visited my website? You're on a list. Have you given a speech about government lists to a rowdy group of patriots? You're on a list. But who needs a list when they can monitor you whenever they want? You've all heard of that digital angel device that can be implanted under your skin, right? They say it's to store medical information and for the safety of children and Alzheimer's patients." At that, the crowd began to boo and hiss. "Now, now, maybe for once they are being honest with us. But you know what? It doesn't matter. Digital Angel is a red herring. We're all busy worrying about implantable chips as we're standing in line to buy the next iPhone or BlackBerry. Read the fine print, people. They don't need to sell new technologies to track us. We're eagerly signing up for the old ones. Oh, and this just in, thanks to our friends on the internet, a place where, at least for now, we can track them as easily as they can track us." Noah felt his face getting hot. In Bailey's hand was a printout of the leaked government memorandum from that afternoon meeting at the office, the one he'd spent his entire morning trying to nullify. It was effectively harmless now, it was a non-issue, and he repeated that to himself, but the smug look coming from the guy on stage had already gotten under his skin. "If you speak out against abortion," Bailey continued, reading from the memo, "are a returning veteran, are a defender of the Second Amendment, oppose illegal immigration, are a homeschooler, if you've got a bumper sticker on your car that says Chuck Baldwin for president, or heaven help us if you're found to be in possession of a copy of the U.S. Constitution, then you, good American patriots, you moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas, you guardians of liberty, are to be approached with extreme caution and guns at the ready, because you may be a terrorist."
The overall tone of the crowd's response had been taking a decided turn for the worse. It wasn't everybody who was into this line of rhetoric, maybe only a vocal 10% or so. And while this minority wasn't quite to the torches and pitchforks line yet, they didn't have too much farther to go.
"But wait now, just wait!
So they've got us all on a list. But it's not like they're going to pick us up and send us to a concentration camp out of the blue, right? That could only happen if there's something they can blame on us. Some sort of a big emergency. So who decides if and when we're in that kind of a crisis? The Congress, right? The same toothless Congress that hasn't actually declared a war on any of the 70 countries where we've sent our young men and women to fight and die since 1945. The same Congress that hasn't even been allowed to read most of the Orwellian continuity of government provisions put in place since the 1980s. No, the Congress doesn't decide. Bailey held up another document. It's much worse than that. Since Presidential Decision Directive Number 51, it's official. The President decides. The duly selected President takes control of the whole enchilada, what they call in Presidential Decision Directive Number 67, the Enduring Constitutional Government. On his command, the USA becomes the ECG, and it stays that way until our new benevolent emperor decides the coast is clear again. The truth is that it could happen any time they want. In case you don't know it, the powers that be have kept this country in an official continuous state of national emergency almost every day since 1933. Do you realize that if you live within 100 miles of a coastline or a U.S. border, you're in what they call a constitution-free zone, where the entire Bill of Rights can disappear in a heartbeat? That's not me talking. That's the ACLU. 2/3 of us live in that zone. That's 200 million American citizens. Do you know that tonight, in this very city, our kind leaders have set up what they call a free speech zone, where we're allowed to exercise our First Amendment rights, but it's way uptown in a fenced-off parking lot where our rulers and the media don't have to be distracted by what we have to say? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hereby declare this spot where I'm standing now and every single square inch of this great land from sea to shining sea, according to the unalienable rights and powers endowed to me by my Creator, to be a free speech zone. Noah had to catch his beer glass before it tipped over as his table was jostled by the nearby revelers. They were already clapping as loudly as they could, and were now on the verge of getting physical in their reactions. From the stage, Danny Bailey indicated that he wanted to be heard again. "It looks bad. I know it does," Bailey began. "But do you know why we're going to beat them? We're going to beat them because once the truth gets out, there'll be no stopping it. When enough people wake up, they'll have no choice but to come out of the shadows and fight, and then we've got them. Remember what a great man once told us. First they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, and then they win," Noah said. It was one of those nightmare moments, like when you dream about showing up to 9th grade homeroom without your pants. Just as he'd spoken those 4 words, out loud but only to himself, the entire room had gone dead quiet in anticipation of Bailey's big, triumphant finish. And by some cruel trick of acoustics, Noah's sarcastic twist of that Gandhi quote seemed to have carried to every ear in the room. Chapter 12. For an eternal few seconds, Noah held out hope that Danny Bailey would blow right past the interruption, but it just wasn't that kind of a night. Noah stole a glance upward and found himself the sole focus of attention from the man on stage. "Well, well, well." Bailey moved to the edge of the platform so they were facing each other. "Looks like we've got a junior ambassador from the Ivy League among us." Noah kept his eyes fixed squarely on his beer glass, but Bailey wasn't going to let it rest. "Come on up here, Harvard. Don't keep us hanging. If you've got so much to say, just dumb it down so all of us hicks can understand it, and then have the guts to say it loud enough so everybody can hear. I doubt if you can tell us much about the Constitution or the Founding Fathers, but maybe you can enlighten us with a little racist, communist wisdom from a real hero, like Che Guevara." Noah looked up at him. "No, thanks." "Oh, but I won't take no for an answer." Bailey turned to the crowd.
You folks won't either, will you?
Angry applause filled the room along with taunts and chants. It finally became too much to sit and take.
Fine, Noah said.
He finished off what remained of his latest beer, stood, and allowed himself to be fairly manhandled up onto the platform and under the lights. Bailey moved aside from the floor mic with a "Be my guest" sweep of the arm.
I want to start off by saying, Noah began, adjusting his voice to make the most of the sound system, that because of my job, I'm in a unique position to know for certain that most of what's been said here tonight is absolutely true.
The crowd quieted down considerably upon hearing this, as it assumed they would.
Let me see if I can confirm some of the speculation from earlier speakers. The Federal Reserve isn't federal at all. You're right. It's basically a privately owned bank, a cartel, that loans you your own money at interest, and its creation was the beginning of the end of the free market system. The United States was built to run on individual freedom. That's true. But because you've let these control freaks have their way with it for almost 100 years, your country now runs on debt. Today, Goldman Sachs is the engine. And in case you haven't realized it yet, the American people are nothing but the fuel. The Committee of 300 exists, and the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Bilderberg Group, the Trilateral Commission, the Club of Rome, they all exist. And they are globalists. They're wealthy and powerful beyond anything you can imagine. There are predators among them, absolutely ruthless people, but all of them together really do run things in this world, just like you say they do. There's nothing secret about those societies, though. No hidden conspiracies. They do what they do right out in the open. See, the place where I work is where all the secrets get told, because they have to tell us their secrets before we can hide them. But here's the interesting thing. Do you know why I'm not worried about sharing any of this with you? Because they're not afraid of the American people anymore, and especially not you people. All they've got to do is keep you bickering among yourselves, overwhelmed with conflicting information, or fretting about conspiracies, or hypnotized in front of the TV and the computer, or standing around here thinking you're fighting back and you'll never even get close to doing them any harm. There really is a new world order on the way, but it isn't new. It's been coming for a long, long time. You let yourselves get distracted with 1,000 conspiracy theories, but there's only one truth at the heart of them all. George Carlin said it better than I can. Up at the very top, it's a big club, and you're not in it. They've got all the power, and you've got none of it.
Like hell we don't, shouted a man in back.
Okay, I think I know what you're trying to say. If you could ever get enough voters together to do anything significant, you might have a shot. But that's easy enough to deal with. Let me show you how.
Noah pointed out a particularly hefty man near the bar.
Can everybody read what it says on this guy's T-shirt? You know, a shirt that was probably sewn in Bangladesh by a 10-year-old girl who worked 16 hours that day? Turn around so we can see it, big guy. Be proud of it. It says, Born in the USA. If he's not already an infiltrator or an agent provocateur, then your enemies should hire him immediately. That guy is exactly why I am not worried about telling you things that should be secrets. With him standing next to you, who'd ever believe a word you say? At every rally you hold, if you're lucky enough to get the press to cover you at all, he's the one guy who'll get his picture on the front page. If you want to know why you can't get any traction with the other 97% of America, it's because you let yourself be lumped in with people like that. Name-calling also works like a charm.
He pointed to a different patron with every smear that followed.
There's a birther and a truther, two Paulites, a John Bircher, a freeper, a white supremacist, a pothead, three Tea Partiers, and that guy there is the jackpot. A Holocaust denier.
From there, it's easy to roll you all up together so that no one in their right mind would want to join you. Why would they? According to the network news, you're all borderline insane, ignorant, paranoid, uneducated, hate-mongering, tinfoil hat-wearing, racist, conspiracy theorists. That's how they keep your eyes off the big picture.
All the while, the gradual overthrow that you're so passionate about exposing is happening right under your nose. Yet you stand around here preaching to the choir as if that's going to do anything at all to stop it. There's no respect for you in Washington. They laugh at you. You say you want a revolution? That constitution the lady was holding up a while ago, it gives you the power to revolt at every single election. Do you realize that in a couple of weeks, every last seat in the U.S. House of Representatives will be up for grabs? And the presidency? And one-third of the Senate seats? The approval rating for Congress is somewhere around 15%. You could turn the tables and put them all out of a job on that one day. But you know what's going to happen instead? I do. The presidency is going to change hands, but the corruption will accelerate. Over 90% of those people in Congress, people who are deeper into the pockets of the lobbyists every day they spend in Washington, over 90% of them are going to get reelected. The crowd was listening intently. It seemed they weren't at all sure if this was just another part of the show. "That's all I've got," Noah said. "I'll be outside waiting for a car if anyone wants to take a swing at me. To tell you the truth, I think a fistfight might just be the perfect way to end tonight's festivities." There was a smattering of tentative applause and quite a bit of murmuring from the crowd as he stepped down from the stage, grabbed his bundle of wet clothes, left some cash on his table, and headed for the door. He heard Danny Bailey behind him back at the mic, picking up where he'd left off earlier and doing his best to get the crowd re-engaged in his message, whatever the hell it was. Noah was nearly to the exit when he felt a hand touch his arm. He stopped and turned to see the woman who'd spoken earlier, Molly's mother, standing there. "That was quite a speech you gave, and on such short notice," she said. "Yeah," Noah said. "I've got a gift. Look, I didn't mean any disrespect." "You don't have to apologize to me." Her face was kind, her eyes intelligent and alight with that same inscrutable glint that had hooked him so hopelessly during his brief time in her daughter's company. "I think we might have more in common than you realize." Behind him, Bailey was already midway into a spirited modern paraphrase of a well-worn Patrick Henry speech. By the sound of it, the audience had fully recovered from Noah's double dose of reality and was working itself into quite a lather again. Maybe it was the late hour, the evening-long buildup of alcohol and anger, or the now-obvious scattering of outsiders around the room who seemed to be acting in concert to fan the flames of the mob mentality. But whatever it was, things were getting ugly. Noah looked around for Molly, but the audience was too thick to penetrate. Two men had stationed themselves in front of the door in a stance that implied the way to the street was about to be closed. "Have you seen your daughter?"
"I did a few minutes ago."
"I think we need to get out of here," Noah said, taking the older woman by the arm. "Right now." There was a glowing fire exit sign on the wall to the rear of the place, and though there were probably other ways out, that seemed to be the easiest. It was slow going. Bailey's booming speech and the occasional roar of the crowd in response drowned out all of Noah's other thoughts except one: getting outside before whatever bad thing that was surely about to happen did happen.
"Let's stop kidding ourselves," Bailey said. "We've done everything that could be done to avoid the storm that's coming. Our voices have not been heard. The time for simply hoping for change and praying for peace is gone. If our government won't answer our appeals to do what's right, if they've forsaken their oath to defend the Constitution, then an appeal to arms and to the grace of God Almighty is all they've left us. I ask you, if not now, when? When will we ever be stronger? Next week? Next year? Will we be stronger when they've taken our guns away? Or when a cop or a paid government thug is standing on every corner enforcing the curfew? No! I say if war is inevitable, then let it come on our terms!"
The exit door was almost in reach, but Noah stopped short. There was still no sign of Molly. He'd let go of her mother as the two of them had worked their way through the wall-to-wall people, and he'd lost track of her as well.
"There is no longer any peace to be had!" Bailey shouted from the stage. "Whether you know it or not, the war has already begun!"
To describe the next few seconds as a blur would make it seem as if the ensuing events were jumbled together or indistinct, and they were far from that. They passed in something like slow motion, like those graceful shots of a drop of milk splashing into a cereal bowl, or a rifle bullet cutting edge to edge through a playing card at 20,000 frames per second. But the trade-off for all that visual clarity was a complete inability to act. Noah could see everything, but do nothing. A slate-gray pistol appeared in a man's hand nearby, a man whom Molly had pointed out earlier as a newer member of her organization. The weapon was drawn down and level toward the stage. There was a flash and the sonic pressure of a firecracker or the popping of a paper bag too near his ear, and then another, over and over as the crowd surged away from the gunman. The rising sounds of panic, a shower of glass and white sparks as a spotlight shattered in its mount above the stage, the back door banging open, the rush of black-suited officers storming in, a sudden stinging odor like a mist of Tabasco and bug spray, a loud commotion at the far end of the room as another squad in riot gear burst in. Noah was caught up in the blind retreat of those around him, pushed back toward the center of the room. And there was Molly, maybe 20 feet away, held by her hair and crumpling to her knees, her left arm twisted high behind her by a roughneck the size of a linebacker. Noah heard a stifled cry and a repeating electronic sound. He turned to see the big man he'd met earlier, Hollis was his name, stricken and helpless in a seizure on the floor, the barbs of a stun gun buzzing in his chest. From behind his tinted visor, a nearby man in black raised his riot club, ready to cave in the skull of the helpless man at his feet. In this strange, slow procession of vivid snapshots, a random thought made its way back to him from earlier in the day. We stay mostly the same and then grow up suddenly, at the turning points. What came next would either go down as one of those dreaded, defining moments, or as the final mistake of a bad night that would top any that had ever come before. It didn't matter which. The die was already cast. Just because he spent his days strip-mining the vast gray zone between right and wrong didn't mean he couldn't tell the difference. Time resumed its proper pace, and he felt his will unfreeze. As the black truncheon swung down, Noah reached up and caught the uniformed man by the wrist, stopping him cold with an unexpectedly steely grip, toned over years with his personal trainer at the Madison Square Club. It's true what they say. You just never know when all those pull-ups are going to come in handy. There was no struggle. The other man locked eyes with him, their faces a hands-width apart. Perhaps the man was in the midst of a defining moment of his own. At first he looked surprised, and then incredulous, and then, despite the impressive array of armaments swinging from his belt and the three additional troopers already rushing to his rescue, he looked afraid. A moment is only a moment, and just like that it's gone. Noah felt the first savage blow to the back of his head, and maybe another, and then he felt nothing at all. Chapter 13. He opened his eyes and found her looking down at him. It was the wide variety of aches and pains that told him for certain she wasn't a figment of his imagination. His head was resting in her lap, and Molly held him steady as the crowded police van bumped and jostled along the patchy downtown streets. "Police van?" "Hey," she said.
"Hi."
The light glaring down was bright blue-white, fluorescent and harsh. As he turned his head, he winced at a sudden stitch in his neck like a bee sting to the spinal cord. The rear compartment was filled to capacity and beyond, packed with people he vaguely recognized from the bar. Most were sitting up, but some were reclining, as he was, in various states of physical distress. Noah looked up at her again.
"What happened?"
She hushed him with a fingertip to his lips, and he saw that her wrists were bound with nylon ties. The vehicle lurched and slid to a stop. The double doors in back swung open, and he was pulled away from her and out onto the street. Somehow the news crews had arrived and set up for on-scene reports even before the paddy wagons rolled in. Hot lights flicked on as local and network correspondents began shouting questions, and their cameramen pushed in close to capture the scene. Noah's legs would barely stay under him as he was herded into line along with the others.
Once the reporters were left behind, the remaining perp walk through the police station was a gauntlet of pat-downs, prodding, and barked orders, ending with a final distinctive clang as the holding cell door swung closed. The pen he was locked in was one of several lining the hall. The total census must have been over 300. These were all men, of course. The women were taken elsewhere. Most of the guys nearby him seemed to be from the group at the tavern. Some others around the cell, clearly seasoned veterans of the penal system, appeared to have been brought in for day-to-day offenses, ranging from vagrancy to prostitution to drunken disorderliness. The flood of detainees from the bar had filled the place far beyond its capacity. Most of the people seemed stunned into brooding silence, but some inmates were belligerent, shouting, picking fights, taunting the guards, or calling out for their lawyers, their mothers, or any other savior within earshot. Noah had been among the last to enter, and he ended up pressed against the bars at the front of the cell. His head was still swimming, and he needed to sit, but the cell felt like the 6 train at rush hour. There was barely enough room to turn around. After a time, he saw something that he couldn't begin to understand. He must have been mistaken. The man from the back of the tavern, the one with the gun, was being escorted from an adjacent cell. He wasn't in handcuffs or restraints of any kind. He was just walking along with the officers toward the exit.
Gardner!
Hearing his name shouted out from somewhere down the hall snapped him back to reality. A police sergeant with a clipboard soon appeared with 2 other officers behind him. He reached out through the bars.
That's me. I'm Noah Gardner.
The 3 men gathered around and looked him over, comparing his physical details against whatever description they'd brought with them on the clipboard. It was his gold class ring from Riverdale Country School that seemed to cement the positive ID. The sergeant double-checked his orders, rattled through his keys until he found the proper match, and unlocked the door. As Noah exited the cell, a delirious man behind him made a weak attempt to follow and was firmly encouraged to resume his place among the crowded inmates. "What's going on?" Noah asked as they walked him out.
"Your attorney's on his way,"
the sergeant replied in a tone meant to telegraph a palpable disgust for the entire fickle enterprise of American jurisprudence. After a short walk through a maze of halls, Noah found himself sitting in a small side office across the desk from a person he presumed to be his arresting officer. The man was in plain clothes, unshaven, and rumpled as though he was either near the end of a double shift or had been called out of a sound sleep for the beginning of a new one. It wasn't the officer he'd confronted at the bar. That was a face he would have remembered. The desk was stacked with dog-eared files and clerical debris, the bulletin board an untidy splash of sticky notes, memos, duty rosters, rap sheets, marked-up photographs, and one unfunny faxed cartoon. Overworked, short-staffed, and underpaid, that was the prevailing message in the cramped, stuffy space.
"Mr. Gardner, you have the right to remain silent," the policeman said, his main attention on a printout of some sort in front of him, "and to refuse to answer questions. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"Anything you say may be used against you in a court of law. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"You have the right to consult an attorney before speaking to the police and to have an attorney present during any questioning now or in the future. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you without cost. Do you understand?"
"Yes, I understand."
"Now," the cop looked up at him for the first time, "before I ask you if you're willing to talk to me, I want you to understand something else. This isn't a parking ticket we're talking about here. Somebody's going to jail tonight. You and your friends are going to get on a big bus with some armed guards and take a ride to central booking at the Manhattan Detention Complex. Most people call it the Tombs. Over there, they'll get your mugshots, your DNA, and your fingerprints, and then you'll be formally charged and arraigned in the criminal court and bound over for trial. Though, to be honest with you, since it's Friday night and I hear they've got a full house, it might be Sunday or Monday before they get all of you sorted out and ready to appear before the judge. If you're not granted bail, and by the nature of these offenses in the prevailing climate, and with Homeland Security getting involved, I seriously doubt you will be, then you'll all get on another bus, and that one'll have shackles on the seats and bars on the windows because it'll be headed to Rikers Island. What you're going to be charged with," he paused to flip a set of reading glasses down onto his nose, "is inciting a riot, resisting arrest,
an aggravated assault on a police officer. That last one carries a minimum sentence of 3.5 years in the state penitentiary. And someone among you, I don't know who, is going to be charged with felony assault with a deadly weapon. If that sounds more serious than the others, that's because it is. He took a sip of coffee and flipped his glasses back up. Noah got the distinct impression that this cop had performed the routine he was witnessing once or twice before. Now, unless somebody comes forward and enlightens me on the circumstances, and by that I mean someone like you, well, I'm just as happy to let the officers from the scene separate the innocent bystanders from the perpetrators. So we can talk here and now, or you can keep on thinking about it while you're making some new friends with the general population down in the tombs. And I don't know what you may have heard, but trust me. He motioned to their gloomy surroundings. It's not nearly this nice down there. The policeman leaned forward in his creaky chair and lowered his voice as though a passing colleague in the hall might overhear him going soft on a suspect. Listen, you look like a good guy to me. This isn't something you need to be involved in, but my hands are tied here. We've got an eyewitness in the other room who says you hit a cop with a nightstick. I don't want to believe that, but you need to stand up for yourself or I can't help you. I'm sure you were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, and we can figure this out, Noah, but you've got to talk to me right now. He opened his drawer, removed a small voice recorder, checked its display, pressed its thumb switch, and placed it on the blotter between them. Now that I've advised you of your rights, are you willing to answer questions? Before Noah could respond, there were 3 quick raps on the doorframe, and the Gardner family attorney, Charlie Nealon, walked in without waiting to be asked. He picked up the recorder from the desk, flicked it off, and slipped it into his pocket. An objection from the cop was swallowed before it fully escaped, stifled by a gesture from the counselor that assured him he would get all the attention he could handle in due time. Charlie turned to Noah. Have you said anything?
No.
Nothing at all?
I haven't said anything, just that I understand my rights.
Good boy. Charlie Nealon was one of those old-school, silver-haired, uber-professionals who swore by the power of image. No matter where you happened to see him, he always looked as though he'd just stepped out of the Awesome Lawyers issue of Gentleman's Quarterly. Fortunately, he was every bit as sharp as he looked. Nealon touched Noah's chin and turned his head to get a better view of the damage sustained in the arrest. Then he closed the door and turned back to the other man across the desk.
Detective
Halliday.
Detective Halliday. I want my client released and his charges dropped, and I want that arrest report in the shredder.
The policeman released a low snort, but his bravado wasn't totally convincing.
I put in a call to your captain on my way here, Charlie said. Right now, this is between the 4 of us, and that is precisely where it will stay.
Now you listen to me, Halliday said. I don't care what you want, or who you called, or how far you want anything to go.
His desk phone had begun to ring, and he did a double take when he read the caller ID.
You should take that, Charlie said. We'll be right across the hall in Room G when you need us.
Room G was another interview cube. When the door was closed, Charlie sat Noah down, took a bottle of mineral water from his inside coat pocket, and handed it to him.
How did you even know I was here? Noah asked.
The look that came back said that young Mr. Gardner was worrying about something far beneath his concern, given the circumstances. Charlie was already punching more numbers on his cell, and as he put the phone to his ear, he motioned to the water bottle as though adequate hydration was the only substantive thing Noah could bring to the party at this stage. From the sound of it, this new call was either to an assistant district attorney or the DA himself. But before he could pick up the gist of the conversation, something grabbed Noah's full attention through the thin window by the doorframe. Out in the common area, a dozen or so men were gathered together having coffee and a collegial chat with some uniformed police. He stood and stepped closer to the glass, trying hard to believe his eyes. In this surreal gathering was every heckler, every troublemaker who had made himself apparent during the speeches at the bar. Every one of them was dressed similarly, the differences being confined to the inflammatory slogans on their clothing and their selection of cracker-chic accessories. When scattered among a larger group, they'd been harder to spot as co-conspirators. But all together like this, with their guard down, their costumes were obvious and their mannerisms out of character. It looked like the after-party of a Larry the Cable Guy stunt double audition at Central Casting. One of them matched a picture in Noah's memory to the very last detail. He was sure this time. The man was wearing a loud flannel shirt, a hunter's vest, a do-rag torn from a corner of a Confederate battle flag, and a shoulder holster. He heard the call end and the phone snap closed behind him.
"Okay," Charlie sighed. "Let's sit down and talk about this, Dillinger."
"Charlie!"
"Correction. You stay quiet and let me talk to you."
They sat, with Noah taking a chair that preserved his view to the hall.
"I don't know what you did or didn't do," Charlie said, "and I don't want to know. What matters is what they could charge you with, which is putting your hands on a cop while he's doing his duty, and that's a first-degree felony in this state. Look at me. If you did that, in the eyes of the law, it doesn't matter why you did it. Self-defense, heat of the moment, temporary insanity, doesn't matter. Conviction is a virtual certainty. Now, I called in some major favors, and they still wanted to charge you with something less egregious, simple assault, disorderly conduct, whatever. Then I called in some more favors, and we worked that out, too. You're going to walk out of here tonight like this never happened.
Listen to me for a second. This is a big deal, Noah, and I'll tell you something else. This is it. I spent all of your get-out-of-jail-free cards tonight. Until further notice, if you so much as jaywalk, miss a trash can with a gum wrapper, or play your car stereo too loud, and any of these guys get wind of it, forget about it. Starting now, if you step out of line below 34th Street, there won't be much I can do for you.
I understand. And thank you. Can I say something now?
Charlie checked his watch.
Go ahead.
This whole thing was a setup.
I don't care.
Those guys, right out there.
Noah pointed through the glass, and Charlie looked briefly in that direction.
They were at this meeting tonight, where all this happened. And they were there specifically to start something. When they got tired of waiting for the people to get violent, they did it themselves.
Let me see if I understand you. You're saying that you think an undercover New York City police officer discharged his weapon in a crowded bar to incite this whole incident.
Yes.
No way. Absolutely not.
Oh, okay, not a cop then. I didn't see any badges on the men who burst into that place. Maybe they were, I don't know, contractors, hired security men who did the dirty work and then turned us all over to the NYPD.
Noah?
Charlie said. His voice was patient but firm.
Calm down. Whatever really happened, none of this matters to you.
How can you say that? That guy right there, the one with the visitor's badge and the holster under his vest, that's the guy who fired the shots that started.